So Nia, the Makbuz, it happens.
Deidrich de Derrickson is a cultural critic and music journalist whose teaching and writing straddle contemporary art and music, with a particular interest in the area where the two converge, pop culture. He teaches at Mertz Academy in Stuttgart and the Academy of Fine Arts Vienna, and is a regular contributor to Art Forum and Texte zur Kunst. He was editor of the German magazine Sounds in the heyday of punk and new wave music in the early 80s, and editor-in-chief of the influential magazine Specs in the 90s. Sunia talks to Deidrich de Derrickson about the role of criticism and creativity in contemporary art, the social dimension and signifying potential of today's music, and the links and differences between the art and music worlds. De-dramatizing creativity.
Why are we all complaining that creativity has become such an issue for city planning, gentrification, local political initiatives to develop new markets? We wouldn't care about that if it wasn't for something like a good name that creativity must have had once. And that, of course, was a period in which it seemed that labor was organized in a way that it was supposed to be as uncreative as possible, where labor was based on following orders. And the orders were not even articulated by human beings often, but by machines or by cybernetic control systems. So as long as it was going like this, it was just clear that to refer to creativity would refer to basic human possibilities and potentials. And so it was kind of explosive to refer to that. Today, I would say, since for a long time now, we can observe that creativity itself is a source of labor and of a certain form of productivity. It's maybe time to not even to be disappointed about that anymore, but to realize that creativity can become is a very neutral term. It is something like an anthropological attribute, but just like hunger, breathing, or other things, humans do that, and it can be used to gain surplus value, and it can be used to support yourself. It can be used to produce something on your own or against or pro whatever. So I would stop being disappointed, but of course also stop believing in it, and instead try to de-dramatize and neutralize the category.
An institutional fantasy.
Now, from there to go to criticality or critique, you were saying that a lot of critical potential of artists is directed against the institution itself. And I agree, but I think in the first place, it's a good thing. It has a history of making an issue the conditions of work, as opposed to some kind of illusionist theater-like or spectacle-like production where you do not know where it comes from. But of course, it has turned into, I don't know, instead of self-reflexive, it often becomes some kind of blockade, because it's again following an order. It's not so much finding out anything new about institutions. It's the same institutions. It's the same results that one always had about institutions. And under these conditions, it's probably much more important not to discuss institutions per se, but to look at them in relation to general production of things and artworks, and try to rebuild institutions. Try to not to kind of generally put them into doubt, but to try to take them over or to change them or to develop something like an institutional fantasy.
Mandatory criticism.
Here again, it's interesting to talk about the notion of the critical, because the critical is not outside of this whole complex of creativity. I think the city planners who want artists, who want creative business, they also often use in the same sentence the word critical. Criticality is also something that is mandatory in many things. In many aspects, you have institutions or you have departments that say, oh yes, and then we want a critical artist to question everything that we do. So this kind of criticality, that also the one that you find inside institutions, but also this kind of habitual, I don't know how to say it in English, this kind of mechanical development of certain critical categories is something that is not at all kind of developing anything new. It's also like a mechanism that comes with certain biennials and manifestas. So they produce that automatically, and it's mandatory. For example, you have I'm doing a program in Vienna that is called critical studies, and it's referring to this term critical studies or critical theory, the way it is used in the English-speaking world, where that means a certain number of theoretical traditions from Frankfurt School, but also including deconstructivism, Foucauldian theory, post-structuralism, and so on. But many of the students or many of the people who look at this program think it is, here's where I learn to be critical. So here criticality is taught. And that is, of course, a symptom of this mandatory criticism.
Criticism as the recognition of complexity.
Let's talk about the category of criticism in art. The danger of it is some kind of fetishization of consequentiality. So in critical art, very often people think that if you don't have immediately the institution changed or the audience shattered to their basic convictions, persuasions, then there's something wrong. Then it was, that was apparently just la pola. And I think the opportunity of the institution of art, or what is left of it, or what can still be defended about it, is to have the opportunity to work in detail on something, to be detailed. To be detailed without a regimen, without kind of rule how to do that. That would be science. But to go into a detail without a scientific procedure or without a scholarly procedure is, I think, to me, something that is the common trait of many, many different art practices in many different historical situations that are somehow inspiring. And this kind of inspiration to, on the side of a viewer or a recipient or whatever, to continue with a certain thought process is, to me, the most critical possibility. That is where criticality in a good sense really starts, where you are going into the complexity of a problem. And not necessarily that the work itself has to be complex, but it has to breathe some of the fact that someone or several people had to go down into the basement of something. And of course, this connects with the critique of the institutions, but it has its own right to do so. It is not a mechanism. It is not automatically because it's taking place in an institution. No, but because it follows certain idiosyncratic ideas.
Explaining art.
This is exactly the point where the logic of critique of institutions or institutional critique and the logic of the inner sense or the inner workings of an art production meet. Because you can say that a work of art that can be explained in a didactic manner is not worth it. It was not worth to be produced as an artwork. That would lead to some kind of social consequence that there is a kind of initiated minority that has art like blood streaming through its veins and does need to be initiated in. So I'm not saying that. On the other hand, I'm also not believing in explaining works of art and enclosing them by that. But I think that the organized initiation or the organized introduction towards art can never be satisfactory to any of the sides. That doesn't mean it shouldn't be done. I'm all for school children in museums or whatever, but I'm also have no illusions about that. I don't think that any one of the school children will really be touched by it or will really like it. They just get this information the same way they get the information of what an alphabet is. And you're not deeply moved and you're not provoked to deep thoughts by being taught that this is an A and this is a B and this is a C. But you are going to use it, the A, the B, and the C. And the same is true for what can we introduce in artworks.
Art and music, the possibility of social initiation.
I'm of course coming from a culture which is cultures around music, in which the initiation or the introduction to some art production is connected with certain social behaviors, social ideas, a lifestyle. And this is an interesting point. I think this is something that is true for also all the art that you see in the museum, or most of it, although in the museum, this aspect of it is completely ignored. In the museum, you will never, the aspect that what kind of life you were leading in order to become Felix Gonzalez Torres is not part of the exhibition of a work by Felix Gonzalez Torres. In a museum, Felix Gonzalez Torres' work has to do that all on its own, so to speak, against the institution. Whereas in music, the musical equivalent of Felix Gonzalez Torres, let's just invent him, wouldn't have had to do that. He would naturally, so to speak, be understood and received in a social situation where that wouldn't have been necessary. And the, let's call it, the core of the artwork was already on display, was already working. So this is the difference. And I don't know how to gap that bridge between these two forms of initiation and these two forms of information, one where you are kind of socially initiated, the other where you are just confronted with some kind of cultural objects that you can use elsewhere. In both cases, I think that there is a need for a complement or supplement of the other. I think that also in the sense where you are in a subcultural situation and you are with your subculture and you are involved with certain subcultural art and there is such a proximity and closeness to the art, that is not only good. It is also good to, at a certain moment, not always, but at certain situations, to open up some distance, to develop some kind of objectification of yourself and your desires and your emotions or your affect. So I think both sides can only work if the other is there too. But they also, on the other hand, it wouldn't make sense to force them to become one, which some people do by doing kind of, I don't know, adventure didacticism. No? that wouldn't work. It wouldn't work to make a holiday camp out of a museum or a fantasy castle or something like that.
The location of the mysterious.
I think the main problem is where you situate the mysterious, the mystical, the irrational in art. And the problem is to situate it in a person, in one person. I think this is a very brief answer in a way, because I think that is the major problem, to situate it, localize it in one person, that by being the locus, the place of the contradictions of the irrational, becomes elevated to a royal status. Whereas if the surprise, if the irrational, if the affectivity is localized in processes of reception, of reading, of living with it, or inhabiting it, going with it somewhere, that is a different thing. No? That is of course the residues of non-understanding, of misunderstanding, of supplementing it with your own experience, and so on. These procedures, they cannot be non-irrational. They have to be somehow irrational or somehow surprising and mysterious, but this is not part of the psychology or the gift or whatever of the artist, nor of your own lack of information or your own neuroses or your own whatever, but it's between the two. No? It's between the two components of it. And or it is even within the group or the collective that is present at the reception, that is receiving it together. So it can be a relation between not only recipients and artwork, or but it can also be a relation between recipients among themselves, or yeah, something like that. If the artwork leaves you no other possibility to deal with it but to attribute everything that you do not understand to that eye of the artist, then it's the problem. It's not a problem of the behavior or of the moral or whatever construction of the mind of the artist. It's aside from the fact that the artist might be responsible for the artwork, but it's the construction of the artwork. If the artist structurally leaves the recipient no other way to read it but to attribute what's in it to the craziness or giftedness or whatever of the artist, then it's boring, I think. It's boring to make yourself thinking about one other person. That's just not... There are 8 millions out there, eight billions out there. So why one? Of course, the personality of the artist becomes sometimes also in an interesting way, can become part of the artwork. But then the work of the artist would be some kind of objectification or some kind of reification of his or her persona. It's not that the persona is per se uninteresting. It's only uninteresting if the structure of the work leaves you no other way to read it. But that is this is a structural poverty of the work. It's not the fact that personalities per se are always boring. It's the only way out of a lecture process is, oh, it's him and we don't understand him. That is a boring structure. But of course, I mean, it is legitimate that artists have procedures in order to protect themselves in a way. And sometimes this protection is understood as mystery or is understood as some kind of... they do not give interviews, let's say, in order to protect themselves. And that is considered to be, wow, here is some weird, behind his castle, he's doing whatever, experiments with drugs and sex. Also. But that's not what I mean. I mean, in whatever I'm offered. You know? I mean, Bob Dylan definitely is some kind of a mysterious persona, but it doesn't bother me because I do not need to find out about this. It's interesting enough what he offers, and that is structurally interesting enough in order to not be forced to speculate about this. So in a way, one can think, I think, of artists as very normal people, since they are on a level of how they deal with their living labor, how their labor goes into production of artworks, of situations, and how that is distributed to other people and so on. They use it. This is very rational.
Artists who work with music and vice versa.
The most interesting ones to start with that are the ones who know both worlds and try to come up with some meta ideas of what the difference is. I think someone who really does that in an interesting way is Sadan Afif. He knows both worlds and he tries to, in some of his work, he tries to come up with some kind of abstraction of that includes both institutional worlds, the pop music world and the visual art world. Then, of course, there are artists in search of immediacy. No, they think of the music world as a world of immediacy, and to them the art world is too mediated and too cold, and they want some warmth. No? And then I think what is currently economically driven tendency is that the art world, dealing with objects of whatever kind, with objects or with access or with contracts, it is far more lucrative than all those other worlds that used to be based on reproductions, like music or film or newspapers. Or so this is a result of the digital situation, of course. But at the same time, the art world has opened up so much to other media, to non-visual media or to other formats. There's such an influx into the art world as a business model, because you can sell objects. So even if it's not placed in the center of the art world, if you have, for example, all these labels now in music that are based on producing of a new record, a new album, they have, let's say, you can either buy it as 12 MP3 files for very little money or for no money at all. But you could also have it as a 380-gram vinyl edition with a print and a super-quality photograph and signed by the artist, and it costs you 80 euros. And they sell those hundreds. And basically, when they sell those 100 extra editions, they make more money than they do with those MP3 files. So this is even a gallery-like habit. And so I think that there's a convergence there between the deal with multiples, with editions, and with those kind of albums. Because again, like just like in the art world, the motivation to buy those for 80 euros is not because it's so much better to listen to it on a vinyl than on a file, but because in 5 years, this 3-vinyl set is really expensive. No?
Pop music as multi-sensory music.
That would be my major attempt to define pop music in distinction, not as popular music, but in distinction to music and popular music as the one that is kind of multimedia, that is multi-sensory. That is, I think that is where you have, you always had from the beginning on, pop music is the music where you had a visual idea of who was singing. You always had to know that. Otherwise, it wouldn't make sense. I mean, if you're listening to a record pre-pop music, you think, oh, this is this voice. Ah, yeah, this voice. It's a great voice. But it was not important how the person looked like. Sometimes you knew that, oh, it's a Maria Callas, but in 90% you did not know and you did not have to know, or you saw some kind of not very interesting black and white photograph. So, but since pop music, you had to know how the person looked that was singing. And you always knew. It was always available. And in most cases, not only how the person looked, but how the person was dressed and and so on. And from that on, of course, it pretty soon was very important of what kind of graphic design, what kind of typeface, what kind of colors that person or that group of person was connected to. And it was always this, that you were always receiving these things together. And one can say you were receiving the studio work together with a visual graphic artwork, and you were receiving the live work together with a performance piece. And in the music, the music of it, the music was the connection between the two, the connection between the live performance and the artwork and the studio work. So, yes, definitely, this has not, you're saying there could be an intelligent use. I'm not sure if the use was always intelligent. Often it was tautological or just accumulative. But, of course, an intelligent use was possible too and had been made. I mean, I would say definitely in the Velvet Underground and Nico or the White Album or something like that, as very well-known early stages of it, but with several other aspects as well.
A deep understanding of recorded music.
This goes more and more into a general understanding of what pop music is about or recorded music is about. And I mean, I'd just been to Warsaw a few weeks ago, and there was an exhibition by an artist who had photographed his favorite records, but not the album covers, but the vinyl records and just the parts that he really liked. And he had posted those photographs in such a way on a window that the grooves of the vinyl would, under certain perspectives, be continued by the cityscape of Warsaw. So there were certain buildings that would continue a record by Cream or Thelonious Monk or John Coltrane. That was...
The form and content of records.
The cover constructs the idea that the music or the recorded music is essential. So that there is a form, that the binary idea of form and content is reproduced in such a literal sense that there is a form in the sense of the cover and a content in the sense of the record. But I think it's also in that text that I continue the speculation to the art historical component that you have... that the cover is almost always pop art and the content is a minimalist sculpture because the little black vinyl thing is a minimalist sculpture in the truest sense. I mean, it's in the sense of Judd and his followers. No? So this already exists there as an industrial production. So whenever you were building something with pop art at that time, this was also always in the connection that it's a possible album cover. No?
Music as sign.
In relation to the question of the sign nature of music, of course, when I started to think about or read text about semiotics and music, or the possible idea to talk about music, any kind of music in semiotic, the idea was similar. The idea was also to get rid of the notion of music as being about nothing or being about feelings. And of course, it, to a degree, it's very successful to do that. You go a certain way. You find out about, especially in pop music, not so much about musical signs, but about sound signs and sound signatures. And that is what a lot of music is really about signifying through sounds to a limited audience, a subcultural audience, clearly thinks of themselves as the audience, as them being signified by a certain sound. But of course, there's always the moment where you are doing something with that sound, and that what you're doing is not language-like. It's not articulation. It's not enunciation. It's like what a baby does with language. No? And so you build a body. You build a body of that formerly significant sound, or maybe still significant, but no longer used in a significant way. And that is, of course, part of attractivity. That's part of what you want from music. You want that emptying. You want that getting rid of the signifier. But you only can get that if you had a signifier in the first place, and second, knew what it meant or knew what it could meant as an alternative or how it could be subverted with a different meaning. So only if it had gone through all these language or destruction of language or subversion of language procedures, you finally get to where it satisfies you on another level as getting rid of meaning per se. So, and it never stays there. It can also go back to meaning. You know? And then you're disappointed. Or not. That's really the question.
Macba.cat